This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we look at the deep roots of Trumpism in the American capitalist order.
We speak with returning guest Margaret Kimberly of Black Agenda Report on how we can counter this with independent political action. We then speak with Kashama Sawant, who came from her success as a Seattle City Council member in winning the highest minimum wage in the United States.
She emphasizes her strategy in political action independent of both the Democratic and Republican parties and how that can be the key to success.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Stephen Smith.
And I'm Jim Lafferty, a decades-long political activist and once the national director of the National Lawyers Guild.
We as ordinary people are experiencing a profound change in the nature of who holds power in America today. Our constitutional democracy, however limited by race and class, is being replaced by an oligarchy, that is to say, the rule by the super-rich few over the many. The separation of powers between the Congress, the executive, and the Supreme Court has all but been eliminated. We are getting what the oligarchs wish for, a unitary executive where Trump is attempting to rule by executive decrees. He and Musk want to cripple, shrink, and eliminate various governmental agencies that we have won to protect us. This includes the Department of Education, the Environmental Protection Agency, the National Institute of Health, the National Labor Relations Board, and the Social Security Administration. They are perpetuating a hoax that all they want to do is eliminate fraud and waste and corruption. Don't believe them. Trump has now been in power for 7 weeks. It took Hitler 1 month, 3 weeks, and 2 days to consolidate his dictatorship. After a mentally unhinged person set fire to the German parliament, Hitler got a law passed revoking the German people's civil liberties so they could no longer speak out or organize. Trade unions were banned. Oppositional parties were banned. Then shortly thereafter, he got the infamous Enabling Act passed, which gave him the power to legislate by decree. Opposition by the Democratic Party to the transformation here has been feeble. They welcomed Trump into the White House and pledged cooperation. Despite Trump's falling popularity, more people oppose him than support him, the Democrats have not mobilized people, nor have they come up with a broad program for better wages, jobs, housing, health care, the end of deportations, and opposition to the ongoing Palestine genocide. Here to speak with us today is Margaret Kimberly, the editor of the Black Agenda Report and the author of the book Prejudicial. Margaret Kimberly, welcome back to Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure.
Margaret, the November elections demonstrated that millions of Americans want change. They voted for Trump, who had a record of being a racist, a misogynist, a crook, a con man, and a crude and cruel vulgarian. How do you understand the vote?
There's a couple of reasons. There are people who voted, obviously, for Trump. He won the popular vote this time when he defeated Hillary Clinton. It was in the Electoral College. He actually lost the popular vote. But he, yes, it's true, he won the popular vote. He gained votes from every time he runs, he gains votes. And, you know, in 2020, he got almost 10 million more votes than he'd gotten in 2016. It was sort of an aberration with many more people voting. But I think it's important to talk about why Kamala Harris lost 6 million votes. She got 6 million fewer votes than Biden got in 2020. Why did so many people who voted for Biden not want to vote for her? I don't think we should focus solely on Trump. He's had this reservoir of support. People continue to be surprised. Millions of people in the country will vote for him despite all the things you have said about him being a con man, having declared bankruptcy 6 times, but marketing himself as a great success, being openly racist, misogynistic, homophobic, transphobic, on and on and on, a man who's, you know, impulsive, who punishes people because they'll say Gulf of Mexico and not Gulf of America? Well, two things. Yes, we should acknowledge that all of those things are in fact attractive to many people. There are people who want to be con artists themselves, who want to be able to get away with whatever they want to get away with themselves. They find that appealing. Obviously, there are people who are also racist. I know they people often say, those who are Trump admirers will say, well, he speaks his mind. He says what's on his mind. I think he says what's on their minds. So he is a reflection of a huge sector of the U.S. population. But I think it's important to talk about why so many people who voted Democratic in the past did not do so this time. And I don't think we should overthink it. The Democrats failed to do what they said they would do and what people wanted them to do. So if you'll recall, when Biden first came into office, they knew what people wanted. So they said he was the most progressive president since FDR. They said he was going to cut child poverty in half. Now, these things were not true. He did not, for example, raise the minimum wage, something that would be needed to cut child poverty in half. Even before the midterm elections, they made a big deal out of this legislation, Build Back Better. That would have included a minimum wage increase. That would have included many things that would have helped people who were struggling in the country. And they couldn't get it through because of some Democrats. He had a slim majority. I mean, it was always blamed on Senators Manchin and Sinema, but there's always a Manchin and a Sinema. But I think we have to acknowledge that there is an oligarchy that runs the country. Now it's discussed in terms of Elon Musk and other Trump supporters, but there's an oligarchy, a branch of the duopoly that supports the Democrats. And they've made it clear. They do not want to extend any programs, government programs that help people. They don't want that. And they made it clear that they didn't want that. So what would the Democrats do? I mean, there were these silly, they would claim the parliamentarian would, I never heard so much about a parliamentarian in my life. Senate has a parliamentarian. They've always had that role. But suddenly this parliamentarian wouldn't let them do the things they said they wanted to do and people wanted them to do. So the parliamentarian, assuming this person ever said this, I always thought of the conversation going something like this, we can't do this, right? You know, and then the parliamentarian would go along. So we can't, oh, sorry, we can't raise the minimum wage. Then they lost the midterm elections. And the COVID programs, which were huge, just disappeared. They had changed eligibility rules for Medicaid, for SNAP benefits, commonly thought of as food stamps. Millions of people lost their benefits. So the Democrats did not do what they said they were going to do to help people. And I believe that was a big reason that Kamala Harris lost. Now, the other reason she lost was this coup against Biden last June after a debate performance made clear that Biden was not up to the task of being president anymore. During the 2020 campaign, many people noticed, myself included, that he seemed to be in a state of cognitive decline. We were told he has a stutter. I'd never heard of Biden having a stutter. Suddenly he had a stutter. But you can't keep hiding things. You can't fool all the people all the time. And that debate exposed, you know, people like me who, you know, are on social media all day looking at these videos. It was clear to me that Biden's health had declined. But this debate exposed for everybody. Democratic funders, remember the oligarchy I talked about, said he has to go. So they tried to engineer this coup against him. It has been said by reliable persons that he was obviously angry about being kicked out, and he endorsed Kamala Harris when Nancy Pelosi and Obama and others had a plan to have an open convention of some kind. But he endorsed her and undercut their plan. And I don't know if you recall, it took Obama a couple of days to endorse her. So I think there is truth to that. So they have Kamala Harris, a weak candidate herself. You know, I think it's a mistake to explain her defeat on, well, people are just misogynistic. Well, people are just racist. Well, there was another biracial person who got to be president of the United States. So I think we can ignore that as an explanation. Misogyny, now people say a woman can never be elected president. I'm not convinced of that, but she was not a great candidate. People called them word salads, where she would look like the deer in headlights or say things that didn't make sense. She did not inspire confidence. I remember her website had nothing on it except how to donate for 50 days. You know, when people run for office, all kinds of offices, local offices, state offices, their campaign website will say the candidate believes in this or doesn't believe in that or wants this or doesn't want that. It had nothing on it for 50 days. And then when something did appear, it was a bad copy and paste of Biden's website. So when there were things like that, which did not inspire confidence. There was a lack of enthusiasm caused by the actions of the Democrats that I have already mentioned. And then, of course, there are people who always liked Trump. I think it's a mistake to be in denial about that, that this man, I don't know of any other personality in American politics who is so well-loved by a large number of people and hated by the other half of the country, but that's what we have. And that's my explanation of how this racist, misogynist, con man, crude crook ended up being elected president again.
Well, Margaret, a number of historians have drawn the comparison between what Hitler did in his first weeks in office to secure his power and what Trump has done in the first weeks of his presidency to secure his power. They do so as a way of demonstrating how Germany was transformed into a fascist dictatorship. Now, while there are surely significant differences between Hitler's actions in Germany then and Trump's actions in the United States today, do you nevertheless believe Trump's actions so far show that he is, in fact, determined to rule, if he can, as an authoritarian, as a fascist?
All we need to do is listen to what he says. You know, he's made these, you know, jokes, quote unquote, about being a dictator and how that would be fine with him. I mean, all we have to do is look at him, look what he says, look what he's done. So, yes, he wants to govern as this authoritarian figure. That is true. But I want to caution us about the Hitler comparison. One of the ways Hitler came to power was the weakness of the liberal class in Germany. And that's what we see now. And I'm not letting Trump off the hook as we watch news of Mahmoud Khalil, a Columbia graduate student who was snatched up by ICE, and the government claims he's a threat to national security so they can deport him. We're talking about the right to speak freely, also lies told about him. And they said they were going to take student visas and kick students out of the country, those non-citizens who engaged in protests in solidarity with Palestine. So we can see, and this was at the highest level. This was something Trump said he would do. He's on social media. He said there's more to come. We have executive orders. Presidents have the right to make some decisions by executive order, but there are many legal questions about whether he is usurping the power of Congress. So, you know, for years, conservatives have said they don't want a U.S. Department of Education, for example, and apparently they're going about dismantling it. But the question remains, does a president have the power to dismantle a federal agency that Congress created? Of course, Elon Musk and this Department of Government Efficiency, under the guise of saving money, They have fired thousands of federal workers and tried to replace them with AI. So all of these are dictatorial things, but dictatorial acts. However, there's supposed to be an opposition party, is there not? If you can make an analogy with Hitler's Germany, then you have to talk about the weakness of the opposition. In this case, the Democratic Party. His annual speech to joint session of Congress. And what did Democrats do? There's one congressman, Al Green from Texas, who stood up and shook his cane at Trump and said something that Trump didn't like. So they censured him. And there were a few Democrats who joined in the censuring. Some of them refused to clap. Some of them held up these little paddles that said he's lying and things like that. But if Trump is an authoritarian, if he's a fascist, how is that in any way opposition? The speaker, the minority leader of the House, Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, lamented that he wasn't sure if he had any leverage. They control everything. He said it's their government. I guess he meant it's their, they control Congress. I thought the government was the people's government. But in any case, and I think the Democrats have been exposed by Trump. Their plan was, as usual, if they happen to be in the minority, was to cut deals and get as much as they can. Their loyalty being to the permanent government and to maintaining the status quo more than it is to speaking up for the people. So we have no opposition to Trump. Congresswoman Tlaib circulated a letter about Mahmoud Khalil and got 13 or 14 signatures. So we have collusion. Everybody talked about collusion with Trump, this alleged collusion with Russia. We have a Democratic Party in collusion with the Republicans, or trying to be. Now, Trump has made it clear he's trying to change the nature of government altogether. So there's no room for them now. So if there's really an analogy with Hitler, an analogy with fascism, we have to talk about the weakness of the opposition.
This is Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Jim Lafferty. You're listening to Law and Disorder Radio. We're speaking with Margaret Kimberly, the editor of Black Agenda Report. Margaret, many observers have written about how our constitutional democracy, however limited by race and class, has been supplanted by an oligarchical rule, that the political structure under Trump has been transformed to represent rule by the very rich, that our democracy is being crushed. Your thoughts on that, please.
Well, you know, it was being crushed before Trump. You know, this oligarchic rule has been going on for decades. Since the 70s, I would say, with Jimmy Carter, the president who recently passed away, who was a very conservative Democrat. And then we went to Reagan, a conservative Republican. And ever since then, austerity has been the order of the day. Austerity, tax cuts for rich people. Under George W. Bush, he passed what was allegedly a temporary tax cut for rich people. Under Obama, who the first 2 years he was in office controlled Congress, this temporary tax cut became permanent. So we've seen this in more subtle ways. We saw Bill Clinton deregulate the financial services industry by repealing the Glass-Steagall Act from FDR era. So if Biden wanted to be the most progressive president since FDR, I guess he could have brought back Glass-Steagall. But in any case, so this is what we've been seeing for a long time now. Trump, it's more obvious with this this very open public partnership with Elon Musk, richest man in the world, sitting in the White House, getting rides on Marine One, which is, I thought, reserved for the president's helicopter, sitting in at cabinet meetings. He's helping run the government. But that's not unusual. Who bailed out Tesla? It was the Obama administration. They gave Tesla huge loans. He helped make Elon Musk such a wealthy man. That's how the system works. So this rule of the rich has been happening for a long time. And the difference with Trump is that he's not trying to hide it.
You know, Margaret, several weeks ago now, you wrote a very interesting article, I thought, for Black Agenda Report on the anti-fascist action taken by the people of Lincoln Heights, Ohio. I wonder, could you please tell our audience about that? I don't think that story is well known enough.
Yes, this happened in early February. Lincoln Heights is a small city of a few thousand people near Cincinnati, Ohio. And there was a march by a white supremacist organization. They hung a banner from an overpass which said "America for the white man." This is a majority Black town. Residents there took great exception immediately. They interrupted their march. They burned their flags that had swastikas on them. And then they took to the streets armed patrol. Now, Ohio is an open carry state, a concealed carry state. So they were within their legal rights in Ohio to publicly walk around with guns. And they patrolled their neighborhood. I was pointing out, while there are all of these debates about fascism, do we have it, don't we have it, what should we do, all this wringing of hands, and people in this little town decided to take action. They didn't wait for members of Congress or elected officials to give them permission. They didn't ask some public intellectual what they thought about what they should do. They took care of themselves and their community. Now, Lincoln Heights has an interesting history. It was one of the first majority Black incorporated towns in the North. But from the very beginning, the surrounding white area, you know, stole land that was supposed to be part of Lincoln Heights. They deliberately excluded the industries that employed most residents. So this town, the population has shrunk. I mean, I'm from Ohio, actually. I was born there, even though I've lived in New York most of my life. And it's the Rust Belt, a state that used to have a lot of industry and high employment and good paying jobs for people. But of course, as finance capital decided that we didn't need industry in the U.S., deindustrializing, sending jobs and industries overseas, mostly to China, Black people in that state have suffered. So Black people are surrounded by white people who are conservative. Trump has won Ohio every time he's run for president. But the people in Lincoln Heights didn't care about any of that. They cared about self-defense, literal self-defense with weapons. And I know that is not a scenario that can work everywhere, but the reason I thought it was important to give it attention was that, you know, communities know how to protect themselves, in this case, quite literally. And I think there's not enough listening to people at the grassroots across the country about how they want to protect themselves and defend themselves. So we have a need for self-defense politically, and in this case, quite literally. So I thought it was important to point out that there are people who are not waiting, who are taking action on their own.
How do you imagine the late Glenn Ford, your predecessor as the editor of Black Agenda Report, how do you think he would apply his principles of independent political action to today's political situation?
Well, Glenn was a committed socialist. He was a Marxist, and I'm sure he would provide dialectical analysis of the situation. I'm not as well versed as he was, but Glenn always had that cogent analysis. Wrote and spoke very often about what we call the Black misleadership class, as we see in people like Hakeem Jeffries, who I've already mentioned. He was quite a critic of the Democratic Party itself and its apparatus. So I'm sure Glenn would be providing scathing condemnation of the Democratic Party, exposing their ties to the oligarchy, their dependence on their own oligarchy. But Glenn also was a Black nationalist. So in his class analysis and his dialectical analysis, he would have talked about the needs of Black people. He always put Black people first in the way he analyzed political processes. So I'm not sure, it's funny that that's one of your questions, because I often ask, what would Glenn say about any number of things since he passed away in 2021? I'm sure he would be talking about the need for independent politics, especially for independent politics for Black people, and reminding us of the weaknesses and the failures of electoral politics in this country, which, as I have said, are to blame for our current predicament.
You know, I wonder, Margaret, where your hope lies. Are you still, nevertheless, despite the circumstances of the current government, the state of affairs in this country, are you nevertheless hopeful? And if so, what gives you that hope?
I am hopeful because it's always popular action. The union movement, the civil rights movement, the environmental movement, it's the people. But it's been a long time. So my fear is that people literally don't know what to do. So, for example, a couple of weeks ago, there was a boycott announced of major retailers. Don't go to Walmart, don't go to Target, boycott Amazon, all of which I'm in favor of. But that kind of thing has to be done in coordination with other actions, with political education. So people want to do something. They want to protect themselves from these forces that we've been discussing, and the people can do it. But I think there has to be a realization that we have to relearn this stuff because it's been a very long time. But that's my optimism. People are the ones to bring about change. And we talked about Lincoln Heights, Ohio. That's one example. But also we have to talk about who crushed Occupy Wall Street, the Obama administration. Who crushed the demonstrations in the wake of the police killing of George Floyd? But I'm optimistic as long as people understand that it's us, we are the ones who have to move, and it has to be independent of electoral politics.
Margaret, how can our listeners follow your work?
I am, as you said, editor of blackagendareport.com. We publish every Wednesday. We have Black Agenda Radio every Friday on our site. It can also be heard on WBAI in New York, WPFW in Washington. I'm on the X, I still say Twitter quite often, the X platform. My handle is Freedom Ride Blog, and Black Agenda Report can be seen on Facebook as well.
Jim Laffer and I are very grateful for your being on Law and Disorder. Keep up your good work. It's been terrific. Thank you.
Thank you so much for having me.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
It's one thing to wring our hands in despair over the re-election of Donald Trump and decry his out-of-the-gate authoritarian neo-fascist assault on U.S. democracy and governance. It's quite another to offer and begin to employ a comprehensive strategy for not only combating the new Trump administration, but to also advance a political ideology that challenges conventional wisdom over what is needed to make our country a truly democratic country and a country that meets the needs of all of its people, not simply its billionaire class. Yet the billionaire class just keeps getting richer and more powerful. Last year, the world's five richest billionaires increased their wealth by $542 billion. Elon Musk's wealth alone is fast approaching $500 billion. And globally, we are seeing the highest levels of inequality in human history. So today, we've invited to the show a guest with a radical vision of what is needed to not only defend against Trump's dictatorial moves and legislative plans, but in a vastly more profound way to bring about the end of the unjust and exploitative capitalist system of the rich in America and replace it with an equitable and democratic system of governance. And that is precisely what our guest today is committed to doing. She is Kashama Sawant, a socialist economist who was elected to and served 10 years on the Seattle, Washington City Council. Her election and her advancement of a strong progressive agenda on the council was often national news. So, Kashama Sawant, a warm, warm welcome to Law and Disorder Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
Last month, there was a Workers' Strike Back conference, and you're a founder of Workers' Strike Back. It was held in Seattle, Washington. It featured speeches by Chris Hedges, a frequent guest on this show, Dr. Jill Stein, the Green Party leader, and yourself. What was the purpose of that conference? How many people attended? And was there any final resolution of any sort passed by those attending the conference?
I'm so glad you're asking about this because, you know, really this moment in U.S. history is defined by Donald Trump and his billionaire-dominated cabinet and the Republican Party, who are determined to harm working and poor people's living standards. But on the other hand, you have the Democrats in Congress who have refused to fight back. And in fact, they say that they are pissed at the grassroots which are demanding that they fight back, because and the reason they're not fighting back is because essentially Trump is an existential threat. Even though they claim Trump is an existential threat, they also serve elite interests. And then on the other hand, you have the working people, the mass of working people in the United States, who are completely opposed in overwhelming majorities to these attacks on living standards. So what's missing here is a fight against the rich. And that was why Workers' Strike Back hosted this national Fight the Rich organizing conference that you talked about just over 2 weeks ago. And the conference was attended in person by 300 people, and over 200,000 in total watched the live stream of the conference. It focused on the urgent need to build a fighting workers' movement independent of both the Democratic and Republican parties, which are both warmongering parties of the billionaire class. And we discussed a strategy to build such a movement. And as far as the vote is concerned, on the day of the organizing conference, we had a discussion about the strategy and the program. The day after, we had the Workers' Strike Back National Convention, which was our inaugural one. And there we took votes on the Fight the Rich program, which was approved by the overwhelming majority.
You served on the city council in Seattle for 10 years. I believe the other members of the city council were all members of the Democratic Party, and you led an effort on the council to pass, and it did pass, what is the highest minimum wage for workers in the whole country. Yet you've written that the rest of the council members viciously opposed virtually every pro-worker piece of legislation I fought for. Is this evidence in support of your contention that the Democratic Party, like the Republican Party, is a capitalist party and it will not ultimately do what's needed if we are to have an economically and socially just society?
It absolutely is evidence of that. And in fact, it's crucial evidence in the sense that, you know, most people are who are completely disappointed and demoralized by the fact that the Democratic Party, even despite is somewhat of its rhetoric, is not actually fighting to win victories for working people, improve living standards, help oppressed communities. And we are often told that you should not expect any change in Congress because that's very hard. Change happens at the local level. Well, we did it at the local level. And what we found was that this supposed dichotomy between local versus federal is a false one. Really, the Democratic Party is a party of the elite. And no matter at what level, if working people mount an actual fight back, which threatens the bottom line of big business and the wealthy, then the Democratic Party will absolutely doggedly represent their interests against working people's needs. And throughout the 10 years that I served in the city council, I saw the Democratic Party oppose, as I said in that quote you read out, virtually every progressive issue that we brought forward. In fact, starting with the $15 an hour minimum wage, I don't know how many of your listeners know, but our 15 Now movement, which I launched right after I took office in early 2014, won the first major city $15 an hour minimum wage. With that, we also won inflation increases. So today, The minimum wage in Seattle for all minimum wage workers is $20.76, which is by far the highest in the nation and in any major city. And so the history of Howey 115 itself is an illustration of the true nature of the Democratic Party. A few weeks after I took office, two of the most prominent Democrats, and you're right, Mike, that it is all Democrats. There were eight Democrats and I was one socialist. Two of the most prominent ones came into my city council office, sat me down and told me, it's all well and good. You have rabble-roused your way to City Hall, but we're here to tell you that City Hall runs on our terms and you're not going to pass any minimum wage increase, let alone 15. Less than 6 months from that conversation, we had won $15 an hour. The reason we won is we, meaning those of us who were in the leadership of 15 now, including myself and my council office, we were crystal clear that if we put our faith in the Democratic Party, then this is going to be a losing proposition. The only way to win is to build a fighting movement. And it was contradictory to many of the people who advised, you know, this sage advice that they gave me and other working people in 15 now, that, you know, I was often told, I agree with what you're fighting for, what you're pushing for, but can't you be nice? Like, do you have to be mean? And that misses the point entirely, in the sense that if those of us who are in the leadership of movements don't expose the true nature of the Democratic Party, then people will continue to have illusions in them. And those, that sort of that grip of illusions in the Democratic Party, I would contend, is the single most crucial obstacle to overcome if we are to build the kind of militant movements we need to improve the lives of working people, not to mention end the war on Gaza.
So then, Shama, I gather it's your position that even though there may appear to be, or actually are, often some significant differences between the two parties on certain issues, that when push comes to shove, neither party is really more than a lesser evil of the two capitalist parties. And so that's why we need a new movement and a new party for real across-the-board political change. Have I said that correctly?
Yes, absolutely. In fact, that's why, crucially, one of the main points underlining this Fight the Rich organizing conference that we had and all the program that was voted on by Worker Strike Back members the next day was the fact this is an obstacle, that if we put our faith in either the Democrats or the Republicans, and that's why the working class and our movements need a new party. If we want to end the genocide on Gaza, we have to organize independently and use that as a step forward towards a new party. And as far as on the idea of Democrats being different than Republicans, yeah, I mean, obviously, there are differences. But if you look at what's happened over time, what's happened is that Democrats have betrayed the working class over and over again. And that has created an opening for the right wing in the absence of any actual militant working class left alternative. And what's happened in response to that is that the Democratic Party has further moved to the right. The right wing is further moving to the right. Now you have Trump 2.0, and the Democrats are also moving to the right, you know, alongside them. So you see that there is no way out of this logjam and this sort of vicious cycle that working people are going to get pushed into unless we organize independently. And it is important that we organize on a working class basis. You know, say that this is, make it very clear, this is a class war, not a culture war. It is a class war between the billionaires, the capitalists, and working people and the poor. And if we are to win anything for working people and the poor, then we have to unite working people and the poor against the rich.
Shama, you've got a piece in Counterpunch, the online magazine, entitled Fight the Rich. And in it, you write that, quote, questions that looms over everything else is, how can we turn broad support for fundamental change into action? What's your answer, in broad strokes, to that question? And what do you mean when you claim that there's broad support for change? I mean, can it not be argued that Trump's election was evidence of broad support for change, but in a very different sort of way?
I think it is a deep irony. It's a tragic irony that at this moment, it is someone like Trump who won the election. Because if you look at the actual sort of facts on the ground, if you look at where ordinary working people, and I mean across the board, Democrats, Republicans, people who didn't vote at all, people who voted for Jill Stein and others, across the board, if you look at political opinions, the positions of working class people overwhelmingly oppose the anti-worker agenda that Donald Trump is putting forward, and that, unfortunately, the Democrats are going to go ahead and support for the most part. Large majorities of working people oppose eliminating any help for students who are struggling with student debt. 80% oppose cuts to food stamps. A whopping 90% of Americans are against cuts to Medicare and Medicaid. We got a poll recently which showed that 62% of a majority in the U.S. believe that the government should ensure all Americans have healthcare coverage. In other words, support for something like Medicare for All. And two-thirds of the respondents in a poll showed that said that they believe the horrific pursuit of profits in the health insurance industry and the treatment of ordinary people and the lack of healthcare was partially responsible for the killing of Brian Thompson, the United Healthcare CEO last year. And we also see extensive polls showing, poll after poll, showing that a majority of Americans support taxing the rich. So in other words, it's the opposite of what Trump and now most of Congress is going to support, which is making the tax cuts that Trump 1.0 instituted and that Biden continued, making those tax cuts for the rich permanent. Well, the majority of Americans absolutely opposed that. In fact, there was a very recent aggregate of multiple polls. This study aggregated 55 national and state polls on billionaire and wealth taxes, and overwhelming majority of people, 2 out of 3, support the the idea of taxing the wealthy. And then, last but not least, we can't leave this out. What is the support for the war on Gaza, the genocide in Gaza? In fact, right now, the 46% in one of the latest polls, 46% expressing support for the Israeli state. That's the lowest in 25 years of Gallup polling on this issue. And the number that are supporting the Palestinians is now the highest. It is up 6 percentage points from even last year, and it's the highest poll ever. So progressive agenda, the pro-worker, anti-war, anti-genocide agenda that the overwhelming majority of American people support runs across the spectrum. What you don't see is any representation of this in either the Democratic or Republican Party. And the example that we set in Seattle shows that independent fighting politics, it's what's needed.
Well, you know, and following up on that, that same Counterpunch article also addressed the issue of how, if we're going to be successful, that is, in bringing about a more equitable and just society, how we've got to fight for it in new and more effective ways. And you cite as an example the issue of, which you mentioned in passing in your last answer, you mentioned the issue of Medicare for All. It's a very popular concept. And you point out that many leading Democrats even have indicated support for it, yet it has not come about. So please talk to us about why it did not come to pass, has not yet come about.
I think this the issue of Medicare for All, and as you said in your question, the understanding why it's not come about is actually a very useful illustration of why having any kind of a faith in the Democratic Party is actually the death knell of winning anything substantial for working people. If you look at what happened with the Squad and also Bernie Sanders and so on in Congress, I don't know how many of your listeners will remember, but some years ago there was, you know, there were 6 Squad members in Congress and in the House, and Nancy Pelosi, the arch pro-capitalist Democratic leader, was up for re-election among the Democrats as the leader of the Democrats and House Speaker. And there was a major grassroots push from working people. I was part of that. Many other activists were part of that, which was called Force the Vote, where we said that actually now you have a numerical leverage with your vote, so you should withhold your vote for Nancy Pelosi. You should demand Congress pass Medicare for All, and in aid of that push, you should organize. You should use your congressional offices, which is a phenomenal platform you have, to use that to build mass rallies throughout the nation in support of Medicare for All. this would also push the, and I wrote about this, this would push the labor leadership, which is also unfortunately tied to the Democratic Party. It would push them into action. Let's bring to bear the power of millions of working people, including within that millions of union members, shutting down the economy, saying we want Medicare for all and we're not going to allow the status quo to continue. What happened? At that time, AOC and the squad completely refused to support any such measure. Then you had Biden getting elected. And at that time, for two years, not only did you have a Democrat in the White House, you had the Democratic Party with majorities in both houses of Congress. What happened at that time? Bernie Sanders refused to fight for anything. So the point is that Bernie Sanders, does he in his heart support Medicare for all? I think he does, but that's not the issue. The issue is that he has completely betrayed working people because he was never, ever willing to actually pose a challenge to the Democratic Party. And he went so far that he ended up uncritically cheerleading Biden. And then when Biden stepped down and we had Harris as the candidate, Bernie Sanders shilled for her as well. And then if you look at what happened in California, over two years, I believe in 2017 and 2022, the California Nurses Union and many other organizations, genuine organizations, were supporting Medicare for All. They really built a campaign around it. But the fatal flaw in their strategy was they put their faith in the Democratic Party. And what happened? Again, it's a state that has a Democratic governor, massive majorities for the Democratic Party in Congress, in the state legislature. I mean, like something like 80%. And what happened? The Democrats put the kibosh on Medicare for All both times. So the history of trying to win Medicare for All through the Democratic Party is littered with examples of complete failure. And that's why we need an independent strategy, which means we have to build an independent movement to win Medicare for All. But the movement's leadership has to have clarity that expect to have the whole might of the U.S. state, the Democratic and Republican parties, big business, big pharma, big insurance against you. And the only way to win is to build working class power and leverage the power that working people have, which is of withholding our labor. So I don't believe that Medicare for All can be won without a real serious strategy of mass protests, mass civil disobedience, mass workplace shutdowns. And that needs to start somewhere in Seattle. We are in through Worker Strike Back. We have begun discussing the possibility of doing a ballot initiative in relation to healthcare. And I just want to be clear, if we do launch this campaign, again, we should expect the full might of big business and the Democratic Party against us. So we will need to build a mass movement here as well.
This is Attorney Michael Smith. I'm with my former law partner, Attorney Jim Lafferty, and we're discussing with Shyama Sawant, the leader of Workers Fight Back, we're discussing where to go from here. Shyama, let's talk about what strategies would work. For example, you write about the strategy you used to get the Democratic Party, all the members in the city council, to pass the country's highest minimum wage ordinance. Talk about how you did that.
Yes. So, you know, the bedrock of this strategy is there are many lessons that we can learn from the way we were able to win not only the $15 an hour minimum wage, but also the Amazon tax, which taxes big businesses like Amazon to fund affordable housing. Last year alone, this tax raised over $400 million. It was hugely successful. We have won unprecedented renters' rights victories for working class people. And the way we did that, and as I said, the bedrock of all of this was knowing your enemy, knowing that the Democratic Party, the bosses, the corporate landlords, Amazon Corporation, Jeff Bezos, billionaires, they're not going to be on your side. And understanding that the reason they will fight tooth and nail against you, even for what seem like moderate improvements in our living standards, is because one, capitalism is a zero-sum game. So the only meaningful improvements in our living standards can come if we demand a share of the profits that they have stolen, bosses have stolen through our labor. They don't want any hit on their bottom line. I mean, they, even though they have trillions of dollars, they are not going to let that go. And most importantly for them, they don't want an example to be set of a successful working class fight back, because that example is the most dangerous as far as they are concerned, because that example leads to other victories, because people feel emboldened. It's a contagion of emboldening that the ruling class does not want to see. And so that clarity enabled us to understand how to traverse the treacherous terrain of City Hall, of politics under capitalism. And that meant rule number one was, I don't go there as a city council member thinking these Democrats are my colleagues. I go there to use my office to conduct class war on behalf of the working class against the ruling class. You are not there to be nice to the Democratic Party council members, because they represent a very not nice reality under capitalism, where, for example, in Seattle, we had 100,000 workers living in poverty because of the low minimum wages. So that clarity that I'm there to fight for working people was crucial. Just to give you two concrete examples of what that meant. One thing is, when we built a campaign to win our city council election in 2013, that itself raised the profile of the $15 demand. So in other words, my election was a referendum for 15. Majority of people were already supporting it. That actually put pressure in the mayoral race that same year, actually. And so the guy who won, Ed Murray, another arch corporate Democrat who later left office in a completely discredited fashion, but at that time he felt pressure to say in name that he supports 15. But what they were really trying to do was co-opt the issue and try to crush the movement. One of the things he did was set up a committee called the Income Inequality Advisory Committee. This was all under pressure from the movement and from my election. But what they were trying to do was to subvert the movement. And so what they did was set up this committee, and he invited me to be on this committee thinking that I would either refuse and isolate myself and my movement, or that I would join and then get co-opted and sell out. Well, we did neither. I said that I will join this committee, but as a representative of working people, and I'm not going to be held to any gag order or non-disclosure agreement with this committee. He was forced to agree. And when he announced that committee at the press conference, I said, I'm joining this committee as a shop steward for working people, just like a union shop steward should fight for their members. That's the approach that allowed people to see, and the Democrats to see clearly, we're not going to sell out. Another concrete example is some of the labor leadership who were also forced to support this, but actually were very tied to big business. One day, when there was huge, the largest ever support for 15 at the time, one of the most prominent labor leaders came in, in a private labor caucus meeting that I was a part of, said, oh, I've talked to these business leaders. Look, we are doomed. He's saying that we are doomed when we have the highest support in the polls, by the way. Just look at the dishonesty. He said, oh, we're doomed. We can't win 15. We have to settle for 11. And I'm afraid that if we don't settle for 11, we're not going to win anything. You know, there were other people who were weeping in that room. What I did was I said, if this is absolutely shameful for you to peddle this lie, if you try to go ahead with this, tomorrow morning I will hold a press conference alongside workers and 15 Now activists and expose this. If you want it, go ahead. And what happened? He backed down. That's the kind of clear and relentless fighting approach you need in order to fight for working people. And that is the only basis on which we will win.
Well, going back now for a moment to the Workers' Strike Back Conference and Convention last month, you proposed a Fight the Rich campaign, and it made a number of demands. What are those demands, and what is your strategy, more importantly, for winning those demands?
Yes, the demands are all very important, and I would urge people to go to the Workers' Strike Back website, which is workersstrikeback.org, where you can read them in more detail. But very quickly, I can share with you that we agreed on 10 demands, which is fight the rich and the billionaire class and their system. Workers need a real raise, $25 an hour minimum wage, good union jobs for all, stop climate catastrophe, take big energy corporations into workers' ownership, fight racism, sexism, and all oppression, stop mass deportations, Medicare for all and quality affordable housing, tax the rich, end the genocidal war on Gaza, no military aid, no occupation, bring down Trump, the billionaires, and their two parties. Last but not least, no more sellouts. We need a new mass party. And as far as the strategy to win, obviously, we are not going to be able to win all at once, but it is important for us. Then the reason we always, as socialists, we proceed on the, first on the basis of laying out a political program, because without having that program as a political compass, it is impossible to guide the movement to fruition, to success. So this is the basis, political basis of our analytical basis, if you will, of what we're doing. And then the strategy then comes down to also very concrete issues. Like I said, we are a growing organization and it is incredible the degree of support we've had from working people. Every day we get emails from working people saying, I want to join Worker Strike Back. But tragically for the working class, the big labor leaders, the NGO leaders, the people who could build, who have billions of dollars at their disposal and who could build mass organizations are refusing to do it because they are in alliance with the Democratic Party. And often they are what I would call business unionist leaders, meaning they have this idea of sort of making peace with the bosses and not really bringing the full might of the working class into strike action. Because of all of that, we are starting small. So Worker Strike Back, while it's growing, it's today 900 members, we still have to grow much bigger. And so in the meanwhile, we have to pick battles that we can win, offensive battles, offensive meaning winning victories that we don't have in place right now, like Medicare for All. And so in order to build a nationwide push for Medicare for All, we believe a concrete strategy would be, as I was saying earlier, to put forward a ballot initiative fight in Seattle, where we have the biggest forces for Worker Strike Back, and you know, use that as a stepping point. And we know that this type of strategy can succeed, because look at what happened with $15 an hour. We won it in Seattle. After that, it emboldened working people and the labor movement in other cities to win. So we saw $15 an hour winning in city after city, state after state. Still, even now, it's happening. Like just in this last election, last year, the state of Missouri, the majority of voters voted for Trump, but that majority of voters also voted $15 an hour.
How can listeners find your writings, follow your work, get involved in your work if they so are so inclined?
Yes, well, people can definitely go to Workers Strike Back, all one word, workersstrikeback.org. You can find all our event listings. We have monthly meetings every day. And if you're able to join a Workers Strike Back watch party or a chapter meeting, monthly meeting in your city, if you're in Boston or Chicago or Kansas City or Seattle, or you can log into our national Zoom meetings every month. All that information is over there. A lot of our articles and writings are there as well. And for those of your listeners who are not only finding this whole message compelling, but also think that they maybe are ready to join a socialist organization, I would invite them to join Revolutionary Workers, which is my socialist organization, which is part of the leadership of Workers Strike Back.
Aha. Uh-huh. Thank you so much. We are so pleased that you were able to join us today here at Law and Disorder.
Thank you so much for having me.
If you have any comments or questions about this segment or any others, please visit us at lawanddisorder.org.